When we come in and create a brand, we're not making it, we're extracting it. And we're making it so that it can be repeated over and over again, so that it can become big and amplify and have scale.
Hey there, Powder Keg fans. Welcome to episode 73 of Powder Keg Igniting Startups, the show for entrepreneurs, leaders, and innovators building remarkable tech companies and communities outside of Silicon Valley. I'm your host, Matt Hunkler, and I'm really excited for today's show because I get to introduce you to one of the leading experts in one of the most important elements of any company, your brand, and more specifically, your employer brand. And we'll talk a little bit more about what we mean by employer brand in just a minute. It's with one of the best branding agencies in the country, the largest full-service marketing agency in Indiana, Element 3. And we have founder and CEO Tiffany Sauter here on the podcast today. Tiffany, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. I'm pumped.
We are really excited to have you. I'm going to gush on you here just a little bit, give a little bit of high level on your background. It's hard to pick just a few things. So I actually had Meg do this because I was looking at your bio and I was like, oh my gosh, I don't want to leave anything out. So if anything gets left out, it's Meg's fault.
This is so stressful. I hate this.
Tiffany, you founded Element 3 in 2006. You've grown the company into the largest full-service marketing agency in Indiana. Congratulations. Recognized as Inc. 5000 fastest-growing company for the last five consecutive years. That's amazing. You coach companies across the country on how to tell bold stories. And to top it all off, you're a mom of three daughters. And we were just talking about your amazing smoothie recipes.
Yes, and aspiring chef, that's right.
Nice, I like it. Well, maybe we'll get to that today. But I would really like to talk to you just a little bit about where were you in 2006 when you decided to start Element 3? How did you get to this moment in time when you decided I'm going to start a branding and marketing agency?
Well, I don't know if you've had those things in life that like you kind of look back and they picked you more than you picked it. I grew up in a like real crazy entrepreneurial home. My dad has never worked for anyone else a day in his life, which was very normal to me growing up. But now as an adult, I look back at that and think that's pretty crazy.
It's a little different. What was his business?
So he farmed when I was little. And then when I was in third grade, he started a pallet company like, you know, that use fork trucks to move inventory and
warehouses. Now hipsters make furniture out of?
Yeah, precisely, and barn doors and all that kind of stuff. And so he grew that to be the largest east of the Mississippi, primarily focused on pharmaceutical and food. So if you think about those industries, they're fairly inelastic in demand, so he was real strategic about that. So I grew up doing businessy things. People talk about like my dad threw baseballs with me, or you know, and my dad taught us financial literacy. We started companies when we were like sixth and seventh grade.
Did you enjoy it?
We loved it. We sold mulch on the roadside was our first business. So if you think about, you know, pallets, it makes a bunch of scrap wood, and so they would grind that into a like consistent mix and then color it.
Do you remember some of the biggest lessons you learned from selling mulch? Mulch on the side of the road?
Well, honestly, the biggest one that has carried through is that I was in, I think, seventh grade and my sister was in fifth when we started it, and everybody thought we were too little to do it.
Really?
And so like farmers, because we lived in a rural environment, farmers would come with their pickup trucks and we were driving a Bobcat, and they would be like, you know, hey, honey, you want me to do that for you? And we were like, no, Dad won't let other people drive it. And so then we would do it and we would load it. And I think that from a young age, the idea of like creating credibility and owning your space before somebody else would give it to you, I think that's one of the, like, of course, there was all the financial things and he made us like file our own taxes and all this kind of stuff. But I think being able to handle yourself and be able to like own your space, because everybody thought we were too little. But we never hit, like never once did we hit a pickup truck. Never once did we like mess something up. Yeah. And so I think that if I look back and take one really big thing away, and I mean, I was 25 years old when I started Element 3, and nobody thought that I should. And I think that that sort of internal moxie is a real part of being an entrepreneur.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which you've, I mean, you've seen that too.
Well, I certainly haven't had an Inc. 5000 fastest growing company 5 years in a row. So a different level of moxie maybe. But that's why you're in here today. I'm really excited to learn from you. And I'm even learning from young Tiffany right now, which is awesome. So own your space. How would you own your space when you were selling mulch by the side of the road?
Well, I mean, we had to market it and you know, create relationships with the grocer and make sure that he was willing for, you know, for us to put our stuff there and at the post office, you know, sort of centers of gravity of where in small towns where people are at and where things are at. And then just like today, while there weren't online reviews and, you know, oh my word, so long ago, 93, there were still reviews, word of mouth and your reputation, all was really important. And so, you know, we grew into kind of a little big deal. And we, you know, as kids, we'd make $6,000-$8,000 a summer, which was a killing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so...
Did you save your money or did you spend it?
Okay, so I would spend mine and my sister would save hers. And then I would like kind of get some of hers too somehow because I was older.
True entrepreneur.
Yeah. And I think today too, like I am very much, I'm a growth oriented entrepreneur. So the idea of like kind of putting my chips all back on the table is a real easy thing for me. Mm-hmm. Like betting on tomorrow. Yeah. And, and then so I have to surround myself with people who are thoughtful savers or a little bit more constrained and making sure I'm being judicious. But even then I'd be like, yeah, let's throw it all back in inventory. Let's get 4 more colors or let's get 3 more loads and see if we can sell through it. And I see that today too in my energy of like, yeah, like let's see, let's throw it all back in. Let's see what we can do with it.
I love it. So take me back to 2006. Where did the idea come from?
So... it wasn't so much an idea. I went to Craner. I got a degree in finance.
At Purdue.
Yep. And I was a small town kid with like big city dreams. And so the idea of, you know, coming to Indianapolis, which is a really big city to me in that time, and getting a job at a place like Lilly or a big company and a business card was just something that I was like, there's just no way that will happen to me. But I, before my senior year, I got an internship at Lilly and then got an offer and, it was awesome and I loved it. But what I realized is that like all things, the grass is not always greener on the other side. And I had an amazing experience and Lilly's an incredible company and big companies know how to teach dumb kids things. You know, they have the resources to train.
Yeah. You weren't a very dumb kid, though.
No, but you don't know how to work. Like, and sure. I think small I would encourage my kids, go work for a big company. They have the infrastructure to teach you, where small companies don't always have the infrastructure to teach and train. So an awesome experience, but I realized this is a regulated environment, and I had only been around small business for the most part, and so I didn't understand the sort of heaviness of bureaucracy. And I don't really mean that. I think we use that in a negative sense a lot. There's just a lot of order in a big company. And I was used to like going with like obvious decisions. And in a big company, it's difficult to get things done in any kind of agile way because for good purpose, yeah. There's order to decision making, right? It doesn't work. It doesn't scale if it's crazy.
But it sounds like you've been talking to Meg on my team.
But in a regulated environment, on top of that, the FDA has to approve a change. So the idea of using just like common sense doesn't translate quickly. And again, for good reason. I'm not like ragging on it. Sure. But I just realized this doesn't fit my energy. I'm super experiential in the way that I learn. Because I grew up in an entrepreneurial home, failure was not really a big deal. So... from that, I realized I kind of need to do something else. My dad had just had me read the book, I just blanked on it. The E-Myth. Yeah.
That was one of the like gateway books for me.
Yeah. Okay. Same.
Yeah. It's taught very heavily at, Kelly School of Business in their entrepreneurship program. And so I read that book my sophomore year after I transferred from Purdue and, that it just changed my life, started a company that summer.
Yeah, so what was your big takeaway from it? And then I'll say mine.
Work on the business, not in the business.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I basically bought a very tiny company from people who only knew how to work in the business.
Gotcha.
And it was a husband and wife team. Like most, they just kind of hit their ceiling pretty early. There was not quite enough money to go around. Yeah. Everybody was a little bit frustrated.
What was the business?
It was the precursor to Element 3.
Really?
So a little design shop. There was maybe four people, a couple freelancers, and a cat that puked.
You inherited the cat, too?
Yeah.
Really?
My chagrin. I just am not a pet person. As an aside, I think there are people, pet people, and plant people.
Interesting.
And I am a people.
I don't know which I am. I like all of those things.
You do? Even plants?
Yeah.
Oh.
I can't take care of them for anything.
Okay, see,
but
that's what I'm saying. It's not a priority, but it's not a priority.
No.
Same. No. So I like plants. I think they're pretty. I'm glad I live in a world where they exist, but I'm not going to spend my energy caring for them.
Sure.
I'd rather put it towards a people. Anyway.
I like that.
So
I still don't know which one I am because I love Hank.
Do you have
my dog?
You have a dog. Do you go home at lunch to like do things for him?
No.
I'll see. I don't know.
If I need to.
Yeah, then you would.
If I need to, I will. But yeah, no.
Okay. So
I think I'm a people.
I'm a people.
Yeah.
Anyways, I've met pet people first. People.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yes. Everyone knows.
That there are those. Yeah. Yeah. Who those are.
Yeah.
So anyway, my dad had me read the E-Myth. I realized that there's people who have businesses that really never were meant to have businesses, not because they're not smart, it's just not their skill set. I ran into this husband and wife team, to make a long story short, and I just felt the sense that I was supposed to kind of take a run at buying this thing. It was worth nothing. They had about $300,000 in revenue. They had a small loan that they owed to one of their parents. I talked to my dad, and I was like, hey, I kind of think we should buy this company. He had some other investments that could benefit from marketing. And so it wasn't like we were buying something completely unrelated to the world. So for $30,000, we assumed their debt.
Wow.
And it was, ta-da, that was the quote-unquote transaction. So at a couple of months before my 25th birthday, we'd bought this company. And I actually wasn't the president at the beginning. I was just going to work there. And then about a year in, I went and talked to my dad, not to pitch him on me being president, but I was just like, hey, I have some concerns. I think maybe you should investigate. And he was like, sounds like you know what to do. Why don't you just run it? And so that was, you know, that's a different podcast about how do you take over from founders. They were 20 years my senior. I didn't know marketing really. And so that, you know, kind of created a transition of sorts. So
How do you have the confidence to step into that role? And I mean, it sounds like you had an amazing support system behind you with your dad, your whole family history of entrepreneurship to allow you that opportunity to step into that. And then once you had the opportunity, clearly you've taken full advantage of it with the growth that you've seen.
I've stepped into it, but you know this too. There's people, you don't get here by yourself. And it's the idea of like, I would have quit on my own.
Yeah.
I actually didn't have what it took, but somebody believed in me enough to push me through into my potential, but I didn't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you feel that same way.
Like, yeah. Who are some of those guides along the way?
There's three people. One is certainly my dad. He's notorious for saying the end is only the end if you want it to be the end.
I like that.
And it's actually
it's
true.
It's so true.
He's like,
yeah.
It's just the end because people stop.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, in startups and funded startups, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
You've only failed once you quit working on the project.
Once you decide it's the end.
And, you know, in a world where failure is sometimes glorified on the negative end of the spectrum, but also like, as long as you're learning something from that failure and taking it into the next thing, kind of going back to your point around, not being afraid to fail.
Mm-hmm.
It's such an important, aspect of this entrepreneurial journey.
Totally. Yeah.
So your dad and
so
and
my
who
dad.
Are the other
second
two?
One. So Marcia Stone. She worked with me for about 10 years, and we're going to start talking about brand. And she's really my the person who taught me brand from the practitioner's perspective. Mm. I think the things we do in marketing often are not learned in the classroom.
Yeah.
You really have to. It's almost like an apprenticeship of sorts.
Absolutely.
And
what
so
was her background?
She was one of the fanciest titles she had was the North American creative director of what was then Bates Worldwide.
Oh, wow.
So she basically flew all over the country and helped their creative shops across the country, like inspire creativity and have the best ideation practices, all that kind of stuff. But she worked on brands like Mercedes-Benz and Jeep and Archway Cookies and Harley-Davidson and all these sort of iconic, awesome brands. And she studied with some really big brand thinkers out of Europe and just did some really cool stuff. So she was here in Indianapolis because her husband is a tenured professor at Ball State in architecture program.
Oh, wow.
Which is a really big deal, yeah, apparently.
Huge.
And so here she finds herself, you know, kind of in her mind, a country bumpkin in what I see is the big city. And we find each other. I'm about 26, 27 years old. She just stepped away from big agency world.
How'd you find each other?
We kind of got networked to one another. So the truth of the matter is I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. I was running this agency and I didn't know the words. So I knew I needed to find a mentor. And so she and I met on Friday afternoons in Broad Ripple for about 6 months. And I would bring to her like the things I saw, the things I'd heard, questions I had. And it was a place for me to just be like super vulnerable with my stupidity. And she taught me the business and she taught me the things and she taught me how it all worked. And I think she saw in me that my brain was like a quick study. She just had to tell me once. And so then about 6 to 9 months into her mentoring me, she's like, hey, I'm kind of tired of being on my own. What would you think about me coming to work for you? And like my face exploded. I was like, you gotta be kidding me. So we probably worked on about 100 brand projects together.
Wow.
Over the course of, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 years. And she really taught me the practice of it, but the combination of the discipline of the research and also the intuition of how you find the answer. And so Marsha was one. And then the third one I would say is a gentleman. His name is Tony Rice. And he was one of my really early big company clients. Hmm. He was a guy who, he and a leadership team ran several different companies for a private equity group. You know, they were kind of like they would kamikaze in for 5 years and turn around and, you know, move on to the next one.
Yep.
And he trusted me and my team with some really big, huge, like high stakes projects. And I remember being like, we do not have any credibility that we can pull this off, but he just sees that we can. And so you kind of need somebody to give you a shot bigger than you deserve. And he just saw that we could, even though we had never demonstrated we could,
yeah,
if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I think people who just saw patterns of thinking and a sense of personal ownership to delivering that took bets on me that were big and unnecessary and unwarranted in a lot of ways,
mm-hmm,
but gave me a chance to kind of like ladder up.
So I want to dive into the brand practice a little bit.
Yeah.
6 months of Fridays in Broad Ripple sound like a really great 6 months. First of all, especially if you're talking brand with someone with as much experience as that mentor did, what were some of the biggest lessons that you learned just in those early conversations in learning the practice of branding?
Well, I think that I think what you have to figure out when you're a brand thinker and helping to create strategies is how do you strike the balance between how much is rooted in the truth of today for that company and how much is like betting on the future of tomorrow and what they want the company to become or the market they want it to enter. So I think that's certainly one.
Talk to me more about that. How would a startup, for instance, that's let's say they just hit product market fit, they just raised their seed round of funding, how do they strike that balance between what's rooted in the present and what the future could be?
Well, I think that what you have to make sure you're doing is that the brand at its best is actually almost wholly unrelated to the product. And getting past the thing you sell and saying, whether we're a soup kitchen or we're a technology company, and I'm being a little extreme to make the point, we found the nucleus of who we are. And this, at its values, its core, its moray, this is what we're about. And so that might look like something like customer obsession. Let's say that that's what the brand is about. Well, we can demonstrate that to different markets through a product that we bring them. But if we are customer obsessed, we may think about what are the an application might be, what are the frustrations that people have when they're trying to buy the thing we sell them? And how do we make the comparison process easier for them? I know technology is big on the like little checkbox thing, but
sure.
That would be one encouragement. The other thing that I would say that Marsha taught me is that when you're going through research, for as long as you possibly can, suspend conclusion and try to look at the data purely. And I would ask her, like, what are you seeing? What do you think? Like, as research is coming in, and she's like, I don't know yet. And I would get so bugged. But what she was able to do inside her like brain is create the discipline of, I want to look at each piece of information as if it's the first thing I'm seeing first.
That's discipline.
And then you step back and start to say, now what are the patterns I'm seeing? But often in research, particularly qualitative research, which is maybe you want to talk about that, maybe not. That's my bias for brand, is that qualitative research is
focus groups, stronger. Interviews.
Yeah, I think quantitative research can get a little dicey, but it also has its place. But yeah, qualitative research is that you can start forcing conclusion before you've looked through the entire data set. And she just had profound discipline in that.
Mm. And in terms of, let's say you're starting to see some patterns emerge, or maybe you're not supposed to see patterns emerge based on what you're saying is suspend conclusion. Mm-hmm. But let's say you've looked at enough. I'm using air quotes right now. This is not a video podcast. Let's say you've looked at enough and you start to get a feel for at least directionally where you want to go. I know that there are some brand marketers that are sort of like, until you've got kind of like your brand lens, don't touch the brand, don't do anything to it. Whereas in the startup world, a lot of times there's this sort of like iterative nature to brand, where it's sort of like, you know, company will raise $1 million, $2 million on pursuing a problem. And really to start, like, that problem is their brand. We're solving this problem. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of like directionally where they're going. Mm-hmm. But it's not quite, you know, we are customer obsessed even. I mean, that would be very specific. Mm-hmm. It's more like we're building products to solve this problem. There's sort of probably a gray in between. But how do you sort of like find that balance between the sort of like more traditional, like if you watch Mad Men and it's sort of like the big reveal, this is how we're going to talk about everything, versus in the startup world where you don't really even know what the product is because you don't have full product market fit, but brand is still important. How do you talk to entrepreneurs who are, and it doesn't have to be startup, it could even be at more of a scaling stage company. How do you talk to them about brand and suspending conclusion?
Yeah, there is definitely a place and time where it's too early to go through a formal brand exercise.
Okay.
And you should feel, you know, if someone is listening to this and they're really at startup, ground zero, trying to figure out product market fit and grinding through that process, making it up is totally fine. and you are, and this is what...
Using intuition.
Yeah, because you're not, I always say, who's the closest person on the planet to the answer? Probably you. You know, you, the person who's got this idea.
Their investors hope so.
Yeah. You, the person who's, you know, imagining that this thing is going to solve a problem in the marketplace that people may or may not be noticing right now. And so somebody's got to be like, I'm the one closest to the answer in, on the planet. And so I'm just going to pick it. And it is iterative, and it, you, and that's okay. I think that the place I see startups go wrong is that just because you want it to be the answer doesn't mean that it is. And make sure that it's authentic to the thing you can be and deliver. Mm. And I think in an age of a lot of just social pressure of, you know, the way social media plays up what tech companies should be, or tech leaders, or even advertising, or women in business, or young people in business, or like, make sure it's like actually your jam. And that would be the thing that I would just continue to,
because
especially when you know that you're kind of faking it to make it because you're just scrapping everything together, it is really tempting to become a chameleon to what you think the thing needs you to be. And that, it just won't last.
How do you stay on path?
Well, I think if it's true, it's easier. You know, I mean, maybe that's such the like obvious answer. But I also think there's always this tension between the product, maybe this is said a better way, the scale and inertia behind a business growth and the brand staying on pace with one another. It seems like the brand is either a little ahead or a little behind. And that, I guess, again, I would just say, looking at you know, hundreds of companies, that's a normal thing. And nobody is able to kind of keep perfect tension across that growth. I'm also using my hands right now to try to explain this to Matt. Nobody's able to keep perfect tension in that string, you know, as you kind of go up the growth curve. And that's pretty normal. I'll add this. One of the biggest things I actually see founders, leaders struggle with, there's like three steps. One is defining the thing. What is the brand? And they're actually, I would say like they're decent at that. Mm. The thing they really suck at, and this is what I think the brand process helps tease out, is how do you say it in a way that people understand it and the message can scale? And so I think if I'm really honest with myself about what these big formal brand projects bring to the table, it's not usually a surprise. Mm. It's a tool of like, that's what I've been trying to say. And it gives us a platform and information to be able to help that leader or that leadership team or that, you know, product team be able to say, now, how do you weave this through everything so that you make it more true? Because it's already true. Right. When we come in and create a brand, we're not making it. We're extracting it. And we're making it so that it can be repeated over and over again so that it can become big and amplify and have scale. And so I think maybe my brain is connecting back to your original question, which is like, if you're small and agile and nimble and you don't have the resources and you're still trying to figure it out, well, it's easier to kind of keep that nucleus close because you are both creating and executing almost in the same motion. It's that when it gets bigger, that gets so hard and that dissonance starts to create a lot of problems for cultures and organizations and markets and industry, all those kinds of things.
What is like minimum viable brand lens? Like, what would you suggest even a startup have at least documented, and not necessarily a formal branding process, but maybe a formal branding process to kind of say every company should have at least like, what's the, you know, what is it? Is it the one word that you would associate with that company and the three ways that they, what are sort of those like building blocks?
So that's a great question. I haven't thought about it that way before, but I will work to answer it. I think one.
We'll make up the acronym because startups love
acronyms. Okay, that's such a
MVB,
good idea.
MVB, Minimum Viable Brand.
Yeah, that's a great idea. That's a white paper. So I think one is definitely your values. That is a core piece.
Yeah.
And if you don't know how to say those, recruit like your closest people to extract to you what they see and experience. So values, who you believe your target customer is, and a composite of the things competing for their time and money, not just the thing you're selling them. I think that's sometimes a blind spot I see people make is they think the only thing occupying the brain space is the thing they're selling this customer. And then the third one that I would say is a mood board. Like go to, you know, Half Price Books and buy a bunch of magazines and get out your paste and scissors and a big piece of poster board and pull out the imagery, the language, the words that you want your brand to feel like. And when you think about it being its best self, like what clothes is it going to wear? And that starts to create at least aligned inspiration for people who are making for your brand. And that could be sales pitch language, your PowerPoints, onboarding materials for employees, or an ad in a, you know, at a trade show. It can suspend across all those things. But attitudinally, how do you want this thing to show up? Hmm. That would be the other piece.
I love that. Mood board. Mm-hmm. We don't have a mood board at Powder Keg yet.
Well, maybe we'll do that.
I know what I'm doing tomorrow.
Send me a picture.
Yeah, totally. I will totally send you our picture of our mood board.
But you know what you want it to feel like.
Of course.
Yeah. It's intuitive. So that's what founders have to do is how do I take what's intuitive to me and make it so others can participate in it?
Yeah.
And that is really what the brand process is all about. We want to take what intuitively are consumers wanting from you. Mm-hmm. What do you intuitively want to make in the world as a founder? That's really what the process does.
I love that. I'm excited to do it. I'm going to get messy this weekend. Let's transition a little bit and get a little bit more specific with brand, because there is obviously an emerging opportunity, particularly in tech, around employer brand, because recruiting is quickly becoming, if not already is, the number one issue for tech companies. In fact, when we did the U.S. tech census in 2018, across all of the cities we surveyed, thousands of people in these tech communities, we found that the number one pain point at these companies is retaining and recruiting the right talent to help them grow and scale. And they just can't do it fast enough. It's expensive. It's hard to find the right culture fit, going back to values. And employer branding, I know, is a tool. An employer brand can be a tool to help attract and retain that right talent. When did you start to see that sort of theme emerge around employer brand? And how do you even define employer brand internally at Element 3?
Yeah, so I think that that would be another one of those situations where, like, it kind of found us. We started to find about 3 years after we created corporate brands that the HR team or the leadership team would come back around and say, hey, we're starting to see that there's an application for this. How do we take this market message and start to make it relevant internally? And so we started to understand, we started to look at, well, how does the process map to that? How do we make sure the core components? And I think it's the exact same thing, but how we think about it is that, you know, we want to make sure that we are certainly representing the best of that company in who they are and what they can give their employee. But the other thing that we're doing is that we're articulating it so that it can be repeated, and not just those who connect to the CEO get charged up and goosebumps by the cause, but also the midline directors and the managers and are all speaking the same thing and understand what the ethos of the whole place is about. And I think that what employees want today, that especially, I don't know how much this plays in the tech space, but when I see, look at more traditional corporations that are run and led by kind of past generations, the idea of a defined purpose and it being much bigger than the thing you're making is something that, you know, the new employee generation is really asking for.
Definitely true at tech companies, large and small.
And so I actually think the challenge is, how does this idea of purpose not become so benign that they all sound the same? Because just like integrity used to be a corporate value and now we roll our eyes, I think we run the risk of some of that with this sort of purpose language, that it's like we want to change the world, and how do we be really specific and pointed about that? And the other thing I really encourage people to think about, it's about more than just giving back, right? The like altruism of it is important, but it's bigger than just corporate social responsibility. It's got to be more specific than that.
So I totally buy into the idea of employer brand and employer branding. Let's take a step back and say, maybe I just bought into the idea of it. Where do I start in terms of creating an employer brand strategy? If I want to retain my talent while also creating a magnet to attract more of the right kind of people, where do I even start with a strategy? Mm-hmm. What's the first step?
Yeah, I think that it's making sure that the leadership team is aligned to seeing it all the way through. Mm. And I would, one of the things when we are in like the sales process for this is, if I'm working with somebody on HR and talent, is to say, you need to make sure that your CEO is not only just politically on board with this, but is willing to spend money on it. Because it's not enough to come up with the answer. You have to continually fund this.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you get a really big black eye. And companies aren't used to spending money on this yet, if we're really honest with ourselves. There's invisible money being spent against it in the turnover and employee loss. And, you know, we know intuitively it's expensive when people turn over. Sure. But it doesn't show up necessarily as a line item on our P&L,
right.
You know?
Right.
So one is to make sure that you're like, your heart is really into it and that you're willing to spend money and sort of see it through. The other is to start with a baseline. Where are you right now? And I know Powder Keg is thinking hard about this of, you know, what does engagement look like in our employee base? Where are we? And what are the things that our employees would say we're doing a good job and a bad job at from a leadership and culture perspective? I think there's such tight symbiotic relationship between culture and leadership. And so that would be the next thing I would do, is make sure that you have a decent baseline.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes, really looks at how do we create some real answers to who are we and what do we want it to feel like and look like to be an employee here. And not just task orientation, but the core of it. What do we want to attract?
So it's sort of the same thing as with the brand. You figure out what you've got. You're just trying to figure out what is the one core guiding light.
What are you going to do better than anybody else? And that's where it's like, you got to be able to like ship against that. Like you have to be able to really do it in a crescendoed way that nobody else is going to do that. In our world, Element 3's sort of core why is about writing bold stories. And I talked a little bit in the earlier, like the people who have given me opportunities to do things I just straight up wasn't ready for is what gave me a results not typical life, right?
Yeah.
And not everybody is born into an entrepreneurial family with a dad who's a little bit crazy. And so to be able to create an environment where people can come and they can live a bold thing, and that might not look like running a company for them, but being totally cool if they have side hustles, like in allowing them to bring that into our environment in not with secrecy, but to say like, that's so cool. Like, what are you working on? Because I think the more they're pursuing, the better they're going to be for me too.
I loved your, I was in the Element 3 offices last time and I loved your, like the bathroom minutes that are there. I can't remember what the name
information dump.
Yeah. The information dump. I remember it was good branding. I was like, man, that's good. I just love
it's
that
the shit you should know.
That's awesome. I absolutely love that. It was just clear that like your team kind of took that on as an initiative. It's probably not a KPI driven activity.
No.
But I just got a taste for the culture just being in the restroom for a minute.
Yeah. And so that like initiative of like ask for forgiveness and not permission is totally part of our culture. And we reward that all over the place. Yeah. So that's an idea of writing a bold story, like step out and do the thing. And if it doesn't work, it's okay. Nobody's gonna be mad. So that's what I mean. And the last thing, the last step of that is like, just like we create branding elements and tribal norms and things for people to grab hold on and put stickers on their laptop covers for external brands, we have to do that same thing for internal brands. And we have to make icons. You know, we have the silly elephant and we call ourselves E3ers. But it creates a sense of like team. And if you look at collegiate environments or, you know, athletic, you know, professional teams, there is a psychology to colors and mascots and cheers that activates the human soul. And we have to look to that as inspiration as we build internal cultures, because people will, you know, paint their bodies and grown-ups do crazy things to be a fan. And we want to root for something as people. We want to be part of something that matters, and we want to know that we contribute to that thing being positive and that thing winning. And so as employees, employers, we have to see ourselves as being team makers in a way that I don't think we've totally had to do in the past.
I love that. And we've had Alexis Ohanian, the co-founder of Reddit, at one of our events here in Indianapolis a few years ago. And one of the things that he wrote about in his book was just every one of his companies that he's had, one of the first things he does is he creates a mascot for it. So it's at Hipmunk, it's the Hipmunk Chipmunk. At Reddit, it's the Reddit Alien. And then he's like, you know, you're really onto something when people are like tattooing, like people that you don't even know are tattooing your mascot like on their forearm or on their chest or on their back. And that always stuck with me as, you know, of course, in the startup world, it's wear the startup tee. You see your startup tee out in the wild, you know, people are repping your brand very much like a sports team would. But I love that idea of a mascot. We don't have a mascot yet at Powder Keg, but we do make jokes that Casey should dress up as a giant keg, like a powder keg keggy at one of our events. But we haven't gone quite that far yet because it hasn't really gone through any sort of process to vet that yet. But in terms of that, moving in that direction of sports team and leading a team with an employer brand and employer brand strategy, what are sort of those next steps to kind of bring it to life? So you've gotten a baseline, you've sort of identified and pulled out maybe those core elements, and you've already talked about some of those ways you can bring them to life. But you talked about this being a long-term investment. Mm-hmm. What are the best companies do really, really well once they've defined their employer brand?
They teach it and train it. Like, it's the most important thing for anybody to know. Mm-hmm. I think that incorporating it into your employee onboarding, and one of the things, I feel like I'm wrapping E3, which is not my goal, but one of the things that we've done that has been really successful is all new hires meet with me for an hour to hear the history of the company and where the brand came from, and to understand the stories that built our values. And keeping that why alive helps bring a whole different sense of understanding to people instead of just memorizing it. So that would be one. Teach all new employees, because they're fresh and excited and want to like be superheroes for you.
I love that you're using your own example. So please, more examples would be great.
Okay, so that would be one. The other thing that I would do is make sure that as you promote managers and directors into it, that they understand how to take all performance feedback and how to get people to be better at their jobs, tie it back to your values. Because whatever is happening in their jobs, and I'll use an example, Element 3, we do lots of projects, right? People pay us money to do things that we spend time on. And one of our values is business first, which means understand the business impact of your decisions. And midway through a project, we took some resources off, we put new ones on, and I sat down and I said, hey, I'm super frustrated with this because you violated a business first value. Do you understand about 50% of this project's profit was just eaten up in that 1 second decision that you made to swap these out? So every single time you're frustrated as a leader, it's because there's a value that was violated.
If you did a good job setting your values.
Yeah. I mean, awesome come standard is another one. So if you just totally laid an egg in front of a client and you didn't prepare, you mismanaged your time, you did not show up awesome come standard, and we need to talk about that. So that would be another activate around them. Mm-hmm. And then another idea that I have is that make a peer recognition program where your people are taking hold of the value so that it's not just coming top down, and making sure that you're publishing the usage or being kind of randomized in the way that you select which ones are featured, so that people understand you're watching all of that. And then that when you can kind of help create a current, it starts to really catch hold. And like you said, the information dump was not something that we, it was not an executive idea. It was not, and you know, 2/3 of what's on there is not true, which is just spectacularly hilarious. But transparency is a value of ours. And so obviously like truth and jest all the time. So most of the jokes in there are like rooted in some kind of like, everybody's been dying to say that, but nobody had the guts to kind of thing.
I love it.
So that would be the third one. So teach it to new hires, train it to your leaders, and reward and give your people a chance to reward and recognize one another through the lens of your values and your brand.
What are some of the companies that have done a remarkable job of building a great employer brand? Like, what are some of your favorites that you love? And they don't even need to be past clients, but
yeah,
just ones that you've seen just do an amazing.
I'm a godfather for me in this space is HubSpot. Yeah. I just think that Katie Burke has done an incredible job of everything from inclusion and diversity to sort of being really proactive from the way that she promotes women in business, and just how authentically engaged that leadership team is in their culture. I just think they do a world-class job. It's just really not forced because it's really real. So that would be one that I would look at. And there's, I mean, if you look at some of the, I mean, gigantic consulting firms like Accenture, I mean, they have, I mean, that once somebody on their C-suite, their entire job is the employee experience. And they think really hard about everything from recruiting all the way to through alumni engagement. And I mean, they're just like, they're world class at it.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are great ones to check out. Mm-hmm. In terms of your next steps with Element 3, like, what are you most excited about right now with the business? And where are you drawing most of your inspiration from this year, even books you've read or podcasts that?
Yeah, so I am. So we're about 70 people right now, and my role is changing from being kind of a player coach to just being a coach. And really getting comfortable with what does it look like to hold, you know, people wholesale accountable for the things that I've asked them to do. And it's more natural for me to be like in the trenches with everyone instead of, no, this is your job and it's
that
my job
hard.
To hold you accountable to do that thing. So yeah, in total transparency, that's something I'm like working through and being good and gracious in that, but also being firm and clear, because we have, it's different when you're not the underdog sort of scrapping your way to the top. Like I think I was more comfortable with the, like, everybody's counting us out, like, but watch me do it anyway. That like totally fuels me. And once you're never really on top, but once there's the illusion of you're kind of the market leader, it's just a different way that you inspire yourself, a different way that you need to lead your team. And, you know, in Indianapolis, there's not been an agency that's been over. I mean, it's kind of a tragedy that we're the largest agency in Indiana and we're only 65 or 70 people. I mean, this market, this state, this region can support a 200-person agency. We just haven't proven we can do that in Indianapolis. And so in some ways, I feel like it's uncharted territory from here. And the way that we recruit talent from outside the state to come in, we know we've talked a lot about talent is a big piece for us. And how do I scale culture through my next line leaders? The next 70 people will be totally determinant on how strong my mid-level directors are. It actually has very little to do with how good I am.
Mm-hmm.
So changing it from, am I doing good work? Do I understand what we do? Do I know how to log into the systems? Am I ready for the client presentation? That was what my life looked like 5 years ago. And now it's, are our strategies aligned? Are my people on pace to their commitments? And does the next level down understand why we're doing the things that we're doing so that they can perpetuate and promote and continue to get that in a real homogenous way through the organization?
And does employer brand change, at least employer brand strategy, does that change where you are right now when you're going from player coach to more of just a coach and relying more on your mid-level leaders?
I think that it changes in the sense that you have to have ways of making it. So here's an example. So we've a BESTCO are our values. That's the acronym. You all love acronyms, so I won't go through them, but a BESTCO spells our values. We've always had definitions to our values, and we've always had new employee onboarding. But over the last year or two, for some reason, these values just got completely misunderstood. And I was super irritated about that. And what I realized is what we need is we have this thing now, it's called our core value speech. And it is written out, all of the backstory and the things that happened to get us there. And so that has to exist as an artifact now that we're 70 people. But at 20 people, that didn't matter because I was just talking to everyone.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we talked about structure and the discipline of that. I think that's what starts to change. I don't think it's that the answer changes, but I do think it's that you have to be more intentional, and you can't reinvent it as much in your head once you get bigger as a leader. You have to say, no, I'm going to plant on this. And I have to say over and over and over and over and over and over and over. And then they might hear it, you know?
Right.
And so I think startup-y entrepreneurs tend to like to reinvent things sometimes for their own good, sometimes for the market's good. And I think that's a place where I've had to find discipline that's a little bit boring to me, mm-hmm. if I'm being real honest.
Sure.
I want to like make it a little different because it would be fun.
Right.
But it's not relevant. It doesn't change the answer. And so I think there's a discipline around that that has come up as we've gotten bigger. And I think that now that we're a little bit bigger, I see an important part of giving back to our community in different ways and showing up in the way that I think market leaders should, you know, like take some responsibility and don't just take.
Right.
So I think that's another place my head and heart are going.
Cool. Well, I'm really excited to watch you do it. Particularly excited to bring you to the Powder Keg stage on February 28th. You're going to be emceeing the whole show for the marketing tech event.
With you, I think, right?
I will be up there a little bit, but I'm going to let you do your thing. You have so much more presence than me. You are going to do an amazing job, and I've got your back for sure. But we've got some amazing guests that are coming to the stage. Scott McCorkle, the CEO and founder of MetaCX, is going to be talking about that company for the very first time. They just raised $14 million pre-revenue, pre-product. And they're building something really amazing in the customer success space. Kyle Lacy, the VP of marketing from Lessonly, is going to be sharing one of his best marketing campaigns that they've done over the last year or so on stage there. And then we have some other amazing companies who are going to be coming to share their stories. And thank you so much for being sort of our guide through that evening.
Yeah, sure. It'll be really fun.
It's going to be a blast. I hope you'll come back to the show again soon. We have so much more to talk about. So that's it for today's show. For links to the rest of the people, companies, and resources mentioned in this episode, head on over to powderkeg.com and check out the show notes. While you're there, hit up our events page and register for the MarTech Madness event. It is our biggest pitch night of the year, and it's in Indianapolis, Indiana on February 28th. And as I mentioned, Tiffany Sauter, today's guest, is going to be emceeing that evening. Amazing lineup of presenters. We're also going to have an amazing panel of advisors, including Bob Stutz, the CEO of Salesforce Marketing Cloud. To be among the first to hear about more of the stories about these entrepreneurs, investors, and other tech leaders outside of Silicon Valley, subscribe to us on iTunes at powderkeg.com/iTunes, and we'll catch you next time on Powderkeg Igniting Startups.